This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
Hello. It's Alan Powell. Welcome to The Real Deal. James Fetzer is taking a well-earned break tonight from fighting corruption, lies and deceit and all the rest of it. And we're expecting shortly to have Mr. Scott Bennett to give us his story of his experience with a corrupt government that turns nasty when somebody finds something that probably shouldn't be found. Now, the whole of the broadcast tonight is going to centre on the problem of government gone rogue, or government acting as a tyrant. What can you do about a government when it's basically acting in the form of an empire? You have an emperor, but you also have an executive branch which is going to simply use the law as a political tool to oppress people. Now, there's one other instance that we'll look at tonight. Perhaps I'll give you a background of it. Dinesh D'Souza, who my experience of Dinesh was simply of watching him and Christopher Hitchens do battle over the big question of whether there's a God or not. I never saw Dinesh as being any threat to anybody about anything. But all right. What happened was that Dinesh ran foul of some election financing laws. And we'll have a little look at a video a bit later concerning some action that's been taken to rectify what's happened to Dinesh over the last couple of years. Now, but my guest tonight is Scott Bennett. Hello, Scott.
Alan, good to be with you, my friend.
Nice to see you again, and that beard is really looking good there.
You are my inspiration, of course.
No, I can't grow it up the sides, mate. I can only get this little sort of cavalier-y knight-looking thing at the bottom there. Now, you are going to get sick of me asking you to do this, but I think your story is a cautionary story, and it needs to be more widely spread. Tonight, of course, we're looking at the problem of a government where it's gone rogue, and where government acts as a tyrant. What can you do about it? Do you have to resort to the courts? Which, of course, anybody who's ever tried using the court procedure, they will find extremely, well, unsatisfying, and usually the expense of using the courts rules out most people simply running off to a federal court or a state court to rectify something in the case of a bullying government or a government gone tyrant. Now, Scott, yet again, I think this is the third time you've told me, but you do have to tell me again because this tale has to be told and it has to be spread. Give me and the listeners your history with the American government after you found something that they didn't like you finding.
Well, I never discuss anything top secret or secret or in any way compromising my security clearance, so I always say that up front. But everything that came to me that I reported came through unclassified channels. And for that reason, it's been sort of a miracle that it's been able to get out, but it's precisely because it never came through classified channels that the people who classify material can't touch it. And I'll start from the beginning and how this whole tale sort of climaxed into this discovery of 19,000 bank accounts that have been funding ISIS and the terrorists that the U.S. have been using in collaboration with Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and Kuwait and the other Gulf nations to destabilize Syria and infiltrate and infect Europe. And the money that they've been using, we reported in 2012, and that was the basis of my shell game report, which you can Google shell game by Scott Bennett. But the whole story started back in, well, really 1998 when I left California and went out to Washington, D.C. to work in the political sector. And I got my advanced degrees. I got a Ph.D. in political theory and a master's in international business and public policy. My background had been in entertainment and writing and advertising. And working in Washington, D.C., I worked for the standard conservative Republican sort of organizations and think tanks, the Heritage Foundation, the Republican National Committee, and then moved on.
You really were embedded in the, let's say, the right wing, shall we?
Yeah, I was. I was solid right wing. No one was more right wing than me, in fact. No one was more right wing than me. I was a ferocious right winger in the sense of, you know, my Scottish heritage had brought me up with very strong conservative values when it came to family and marriage and the health of society and economics and military strength. And that whole narrative, you know, part of me still has as my core identity. But what I didn't realize at the time is the neoconservatives had hijacked that whole agenda and corrupted and twisted it into a PSYOP that basically mobilized all of the conservative people in the country to go into the military and wage this endless war in the Middle East to strengthen Israel and the Mossad agents in the Zionist agenda, cloaked as the war on terror. But at the time it happened in 2001, I was under a different mindset, as most all Americans were. We never expected this, and we never questioned the September 11th attacks, because we had never believed that our government would lie to us on such a monstrously despicable and evil way that they did. So at the time of 2001, everyone who loved, you know, God and country and family and believed in the American independent spirit got behind and believed the government narrative. And that narrative was later proven by many experts and researchers in the 9/11 evidentiary trail to be a complete lie. Barbara Honegger and Susan Lindauer and Richard Gage and Alan Zabrowski and an assortment of people have some very good research. Jim Fetzer, of course, is one of the top, that years later has come out to show that the whole government narrative was a complete lie and false and physically impossible. But at the time, in 2001, we didn't know all that. So I had been in the Bush administration, I had been doing government work, and I had been, when I was leaving the Bush administration, I was hired by a Colonel Jeff Jones, who was in charge of psychological warfare at Fort Bragg, and he was one of the top PSYOP guys in the country. He was the Colonel Kurtz of psychological warfare, and he liked me.
Perhaps we should just explain that reference to the Heart of Darkness there. Colonel Kurtz. In the Heart of Darkness, Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, Kurtz, of course, is the, it's also in Apocalypse Now. The colonel there is called Kurtz as well. This is the dark, devious figure at the center of, the perversion of, colonial aims in both Apocalypse Now and the Heart of Darkness.
Yeah.
I'm not doing that just to show off that I've read the book.
Yeah. You're right. Well, Colonel Kurtz was the equivalent of that man in his brilliance, but he was superior in that he had a heart. He had a conscience. He was a good-souled individual, and he knew that things were drastically wrong and going down the wrong route. And he knew he couldn't break out of it with military people and people that were in the bureaucracies and entrenched in the military-industrial complex. And he had known me through a presentation I gave at the Pentagon, and I gave it directly to Rumsfeld and Myers, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, Donald Rumsfeld, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dick Myers, in which I had challenged them about our psychological warfare capability. And no one challenges military leaders in the SecDef. No one stands up. I was the only one who did, because I didn't care. I was interested in winning the war, and I thought, all you people are doing the wrong stuff. And that caught his eye, and he called me and said, I'd like you to join my team. I'm putting together a team of writers and researchers and PSYOP people, and we'll get you into the military. We'll get you a direct commission. We'll have you working in counterterrorism and use all your background and skills to develop messaging and psychological warfare products and teaching and lectures and get basically better messaging out to the hearts and minds of the Islamic extremists. So I thought that's a good way for me to serve my country. It's a good way to utilize all of my academic background, my professional background. So I joined Booz Allen Hamilton. I was given a top secret clearance and I joined his team. And for the next few years, I worked in all sorts of exciting areas of counterterrorism and psychological warfare and worked at the State Department counterterrorism under General Del Daley, who was in charge of Joint Special Operations Command. I worked in buildings that had secret floors and secret doors and all sorts of exciting things. And at Special Operations Command, at MacDill Air Force Base, and U.S. Central Command. And when I started making a lot of observations about failures and fraud and things that I thought were really, really strange, and people started being arrested and imprisoned, like Mike Furlong, who was a guy I worked with who the CIA came after at State Department. He was one of the affected people that were taken out. Once I started making up reports and filing things that caught the attention of Dov Zakheim and the people that were running the terrorist finance contracts, I found myself removed from my job, removed from base at MacDill, charged with some petty paperwork errors that were turned into a federal.
Now, Scott, the really interesting thing here in the facts is the way that this actually happened as you leave work. Can you tell us about that again, please?
Well, I had went down to work at U.S. Central Command, and Colonel Jones had said, you're going to be working for Dov Zakheim and his team. And Dov Zakheim was the comptroller at the Pentagon that $2.3 trillion had went missing during his watch. And the auditors of the Dov Zakheim Department of Defense, they were all killed from the explosion that hit that portion of the Pentagon. So there was a lot of questions about Dov Zakheim and money that was missing and F-16s that were chalked down to cost and given to Israel. So Dov Zakheim was running, and he had high up roles in the Project for New American Century. He was one of the key authors of the America Needs Another Pearl Harbor. He was high up in all that material. So he was basically running the Booz Allen Hamilton contract to track down money sources and money networks and banks, at U.S. Central Command for the Joint Interagency. So I went down to work with him, and I worked with all the government agencies that had anything to do with counterterrorism, tracking down money supplies. And that was where I found myself embedded. And I was always doing everything for family and for culture and for Americana and country and patriotism. And I still was under the impression that we were fighting a bunch of savage Saudi Arabian boy lovers who came on a plane and crashed into the World Trade Center. And I had never really looked at or thought about the alternative theories about, did it really happen or was there something more? And I never really looked at any of the material that architects and engineers and the others have put forth, or Fetzer, because we were all, you know, sort of brainwashed into this is what happened. And you don't question the science behind it. But when I started being very aggressive and making reports and giving briefings, I found myself in 24 hours, I was stopped at a front gate. And I thought this was all training when I was stopped. I thought they were doing this to purposely train me and see what I could endure because I was going to be deployed. And they put you through sort of a SEER training to make sure you don't, you know, panic or break down or anything like that. And I thought it was training, and I was put into a jail cell, and then I was let out. And then the next day I was arrested again, and then I was put back in a jail cell and let out. But then I was fired from base and told, okay, we've terminated your position. Now you go back to Washington, D.C. And 9 months later, and I had gotten an attorney, Donna Shalala's nephew, a guy named David Shalala. 9 months later, when I wouldn't stop making noise and filing reports about a lot of the Obama administration policies in the military, particularly around don't ask, don't tell, and how that was going to inflame the enemies that we had in the Muslim conservative countries. 9 months later, they charged me with making a false statement on a housing form because I circled two little bubbles that they said couldn't have been circled until I had orders that they had received. So somehow that was a false statement.
At that stage, the whole aspect of them coming after you was through the military arm, correct?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't the military. That was the thing where they corrupted the Constitution. They came after me with the Obama administration Department of Justice under Eric Holder and Lanny Brewer. They prosecuted me with civilian statutes for things I was doing on a military base as a military officer, which is the first time in the history of the United States that's ever been allowed. So they violated the Constitution by doing this, charging me in the first place. The military violated my rights as a military officer by not standing up for me and saying, he's our guy. He's down there doing our work in uniform. Anything he does, we have jurisdiction over. They didn't do that. They sort of looked the other way. And I'm sort of the deer in the headlights, not knowing what's going on. And the civilian justice department came in, said, we're going to charge you with making a false statement, wearing a uniform without authorization, and having guns on base that registered.
There had to be someone in the military or in the Pentagon saying to the Department of Justice, go after Scott Bennett.
Yep, that's right. That's right. And what the other interesting nexus is Dov Zakheim's son, Roger Zakheim, had received my original reports when he was at the U.S. House Armed Services Committee. And I didn't know who he was at the time, but I knew my reports that were going up were going to the House Armed Services Committee. And he was deputy staff director and the lead counsel. So he was receiving my reports. So it's most likely he, Roger Zakheim, buried my reports and made people go after me to cover up for his father, who was involved with the very Swiss bank terrorist financing issues that I was raising. So there's deep corruption that needs to be examined in court and brought out in a lawsuit, and all that is forthcoming. But the basic hijacking, the Shanghaiing of me, the kidnapping of me, and prosecuting me in a civilian federal court, and then whisking me off to prison right after a 3-day trial, and I never spoke, I never testified, because my lawyer said, no, it's going to go away. We're not going to put you up there. And I don't know, you know, what the game is. And none of my documents got in that would have totally thrown out all the charges. But for whatever reason, I was allowed to be whisked into a prison, and I was put on a bus and basically disappeared. And I was sent out. I was on my way to California. And this is where it takes a tale of the miraculous, because I didn't know what was happening. I fired my first attorneys. I said, this is ridiculous. I shouldn't be in here. I don't know what's happened. But I fired the attorneys, and I asked for a new trial in which all of my material gets in. But once you're on the bus, you're gone. They don't even acknowledge that you're alive. You're in Siberia.
And in a way, that going on the bus was a weird, lucky serendipity, as it turned out, wasn't it?
It was, because getting on the bus, I turned around 180 degrees at Oklahoma. They sent me out to go to California, but we stopped in Oklahoma. And for whatever reason, you know, we didn't have enough buses, or they didn't have enough people, or they're constantly playing the shell game of moving people around to different jails. They turned around and whisked me back to Pennsylvania. And at Pennsylvania was where I met, besides all these lawyers and doctors and stockbrokers and white collar, you know, people like John Caracal. He wasn't at my prison, but all of those type of people go to a camp. And I wind up meeting the Swiss banker, Brad Birkenfeld, who had brought 19,000 bank accounts to the Department of Justice, exposing CIA black budget operations, terrorist financing, Saudi Arabian King Abdullah Aziz and his Swiss bank accounts that were funding a lot of the terrorist activities. All sorts of things just came. It was the goose that laid the golden egg. It was Pandora's box. And I opened it up, and I met him, and I couldn't believe that we met together. And he couldn't believe it either. He said, I can't believe you and I have just met here. And I said, you're telling me no one in the government or the intelligence or the military has ever gotten your material on all these Swiss banks? And he had all the WikiLeaks cables and everything, because he couldn't believe that he had been put in prison. He had brought all this stuff forth, but little did he know, Eric Holder and Lanny Brewer, who worked at the Department of Justice as the attorney general and the assistant, they worked for the law firm Covington and Burling before they joined the government. And that law firm represented Union Bank of Switzerland. So that old law firm told Eric Holder and Lanny Brewer and Obama and Hillary Clinton, make this Birkenfeld thing go away. We'll give you lots of money. We'll give you campaign donations. The Clinton Foundation will be rich, and all sorts of other things will happen.
And Scott, it's the case that Holder went back to that same firm after being attorney general.
And so did Roger Zackheim, and so did Lanny Brewer. So Roger Zackheim went to work for Covington and Burling in December of 2013, a couple of weeks before I got out of prison. And Eric Holder and Lanny Brewer both went back to Covington and Burling. So there's a whole astrological alignment of the stars of all these guys going back, none of which has ever been known. And some of these people that have exposed UBS and its connection with the Clinton Foundation, they got that material from me in 2012 because I sent the report documenting that to Fox News, to all the people at Fox News, and later on, the Wall Street Journal, in fact, too. And the Wall Street Journal came out with the very story and the very WikiLeaks cables that I sent them in 2012. And they pretended it was their own story that addressed Clinton and UBS donations, why they did it. Maybe they're trying to do damage control. But there's even a case for plagiarism because they took my materials that I gave them in 2012 and they pretended that they had just found it. No, they didn't.
Well, there is an obvious danger with public media getting hold of this kind of stuff because they start to ride it. They're riding the wagon then and they can steer it where they wish to. One of the big things, of course, that they do is they bring out documents such as yours with stories of yours. But if they want to get you, what they will do is say, we were given these documents. We think they're a bit shady. We're not sure. And then what the story will become is you instead of the actual story.
Yeah. That's what they tried to do originally by sending Michael Isikoff and Tom Hamburger up to interview me. Michael Isikoff is with NBC News and Tom Hamburger was with the Washington Post. And they came up to try and discredit me to say, here's another Booz Allen Hamilton contractor like Edward Snowden. And I said, yeah, I'm a contractor, but I was thrown in prison because I exposed all this Swiss banking and terrorist financing shenanigans. Here it is. Go report it, Mr. Isikoff. Here are the documents. Here's everything you need. And Michael Isikoff and Tom Hamburger interviewed me for 2 hours, left the room, didn't publish a single word, never returned any of my documents, nor responded to any of my follow-up letters. That'll all come out. It'll all come out in a court and subpoenas and all that. But you know them by their fruits. You see who they are, what they've done. They can't run away from it. They can't
You're right on the money there, Scott. What they do illustrates who they are.
Yep.
Now, you're not going to contradict me if I say that currently, I don't think you are, but please feel free to. You have a problem with the American government. It's no longer the republic that it used to be under the Constitution that it still has. What you basically have is a rogue empire, I think, and the head of it acts as a tyrant, but there's also a huge executive administrative body that is basically running out of control.
Yes.
Let's take just things that have been in the news over the last couple of years, the IRS.
Yes.
Now, you'd have to be living on Mars not to know about Lois Lerner and what's happened there.
Yeah.
The Import-Export Bank farce.
Yeah.
The OPM hack. For example, the head of the Secret Service getting the boot.
Yeah.
Gina McCarthy of the EPA starts up her own police force. This is nonsense. This is not the, this, none of this kind of stuff fits in with our idea, or at least my idea from 6,000 kilometers away of the Republic. What you seem to have to me sitting here studying this, not having any experience of it, but it really seems like you have very many agencies running away with their power, with an overreach of executive power. And if they want someone like you taken out the way very, very quickly, you get a trumped up charge against you, and you're out of the public domain.
Yep.
And I think that's supposed to be a lesson to you, saying, look, you've stepped out of line once, don't do it again. Otherwise, there'll be another wonky charge flying its way towards you.
Well, they didn't know who they were dealing with, because I was raised with a very Scottish family and a very independent, strong-willed family. And when I grab onto something, it's like a pit bull on one of those little pinatas. I'm lifted off the ground and nothing can break my hold. And I don't stop and I go after it. And when I saw what was going on and started reporting, it wasn't out of selfishness. It wasn't out of, greed or anything like that. It was out of my duty to my fellow soldiers. As an army officer, I swore an oath to the Constitution of the United States. I swore an oath to lead and help and fight a war. And that meant to care for the men underneath me that were fighting, the non-commissioned officers, the enlisted men. And when I saw all the Swiss bank money trails, and I met the banker who exposed it all, and I saw the corruption, I saw Hillary Clinton's fingerprints, I saw everything, I had to report it out of caution and care for the men who were still in uniform that were being sent over to that hell, and they were getting killed and blown up on a daily basis, and traumatized. Even if you're not blown up, you still come back traumatized. And half these young men that are put on all sorts of medications and mental mood medications and things like that, all of that was unnecessary and could have been shortened had they acted on cutting off the money supply. Because if you cut off a money supply, if you cut off the fuel line, the engine eventually runs out of fuel. It stops and they either die or they go home. And we had that opportunity in 2007, 2008, 2009. I discovered it in 2011. I reported it in 2012 and have kept reporting it every month since. And no one in the military, no one in the political circle in the United States, no one in the media at Fox News or New York Times or Wall Street Journal or anywhere responded in any way. Rand Paul was the only one to respond, and it was, take this up to the Pennsylvania people. I can't do anything with it. Jim Webb said, I'm retiring. Thank you very much, but I'm not going to have anything to do with it. Not a single letter from anyone else, not in armed services. Howard Buck McKeon, I talked to his staff. I said, I'm reporting this as a military officer. Well, we don't want this. You're going to have to take it to your constituent. I said, no, I'm reporting it to you. And all of these were recorded on Skype, and all of these were recorded and documented. I contacted the French intelligence people after the Charlie Hebdo attack. And I said, look, I've got all sorts of terrorist financing material that you need to question Brad Birkenfeld about. He is coming over to Europe to talk about this. You need to incorporate this material. And they set up a call and a Skype trying to find out what I knew. I said, I'm not going to tell you unless I get this in writing. And they never did a single follow-up. They never did anything with it. So the French knew about this before the, quote, attacks that occurred a few months ago. So everybody in the British knew this. I shared it with the British because it was not classified. It was simply raw intelligence that I had gathered from the whistleblower himself that had never been allowed to enter the military domain. And Brad had told me he was forbidden from sharing this by Eric Holder and Lanny Brewer. They forbid him from sharing any of this information. I said, well, you know what? I'm not going to be forbidden. No one's going to tell me to shut up, because this can save lives, and this is military intelligence, and I'm sending up the military. And we've been fighting that ever since.
Aside from the military aspects of what you're talking about that connect to Eric Holder, you would have to be aware of Fast and Furious.
Yeah. The Senate staffer that I talked to in Ron Johnson's office, I called him and spoke for an hour or so explaining all this. And I said, he said, yes, I'm familiar with Covington and Burling. I'm familiar because a lot of our people have went over to that law firm, and I know that they are into the Fast and Furious issue too. So this law firm, Covington and Burling, is very, very dirty. It's connected with the Fast and Furious issue. And the Senate staffer that interviewed me for Ron Johnson, who was the senator in charge of a hearing on whistleblowers. He brought in a special forces colonel who had been persecuted because he was exposing incompetence in how the military handles its kidnapped ransom issues and getting people back. And he reported all sorts of failures, and they went after him. Well, that's why this senator had a hearing. And I called the senator's office. I said, if you're going to have this guy up there, you need to have me up there, or at least know this, because there is more to this Obama and cover up and all this stuff. So they know about Fast and Furious. What they don't know, and people don't know unless they get the book and look at it and put the pieces together, and there's a lot of videos that we've made on it, they don't know that Edward Snowden was coming after Brad Birkenfeld for this with the CIA when he was with the CIA in 2007. And the CIA got Brad Birkenfeld, put him into a jail cell, pretended it was a DUI, then went in the next day and got him out of jail. And Brad then ran over to the United States, left Geneva, Switzerland, and brought all of his material, and that's where they try to cover it up. And the CIA contacted Vanity Fair and told them, do not do the Birkenfeld story. Karzai is much worse. And the journalist showed Brad the text he got on the phone, said, look at that. And it was like, weird. Why in the hell do they know you? What is this about? And Brad didn't know either, because he wasn't intelligence trained or military trained. He just thought it was Swiss banks issues. No. This was Swiss banks tied to CIA, tied to ISIS, Al-Qaeda funding, tied to all sorts of Saudi donors that were just doing money laundering, drug trafficking.
So we've got to say then, there's no getting away from the straight statement, Scott, that Eric Holder is in this up to his neck.
Oh, up to his neck. I will be surprised if there is not a future indictment and prosecution of Eric Holder for treason and Lanny Breuer and Hillary Clinton based on this subject alone. Because Brad Birkenfeld and all of his Swiss bank materials, they covered up out of loyalty to their previous employer, Covington and Burling, and then went back to work for their employer, Covington and Burling. Yeah. Hillary Clinton did the same thing.
We're not likely to see anything of a prosecution with Miss Lynch in power at the moment. What an apt name for a black woman.
She is actually tied up into it too, because she was the one, I believe, who facilitated the 2% fine on UBS when Brad Birkenfeld, when they put him in prison. That was one of the conditions. Is Loretta Lynch orchestrated, managed, co-managed the UBS fine of 2%, which came to like, 2% of their profits. And it was based on, we did the numbers, and it's the equivalent of, if you made $50,000 a year, your fine was like $1,500 or $2,500. That was it. If you're made of $50,000 a year, the 2% of UBS's profit was all they were fined, and none of the bank accounts were ever allowed to be given to the U.S. military or the intelligence sectors. And Brad was never allowed to give any of this. Instead, he was thrown into prison. And for the next 40 months, he was kept incommunicado. But that's where, again, it takes a roll of the miraculous, is that's where I met him. That's where we put all this together. And that's where we basically hit it out of the ballpark, like Robert Redford in The Natural, shattering the lights and running around in a grand slam rain of sparks. So we put it together and we filed it, and I think they don't know what to do with us, because everything's documented, everything's provable, everything's historical, and I've documented everything in the Florida courts too, including
There's a point there, Scott, the courts.
Yep.
How reliable do you think the courts really will be as a method of exposing this?
Well, the one thing I learned was you always represent yourself. You never allow an attorney when you go into a criminal matter, and if you really know your stuff, you don't let an attorney speak for you. You have to speak for yourself in the very beginning and challenge the jurisdiction and demand that everything is thrown out and not recognize the authority of the federal courts. Because the federal courts, the moment you acknowledge their authority or their jurisdiction or go into, and you know this well, you play on their playground, you're instantly hobbled. But if you go in and you refuse to accept them, you refuse their jurisdiction, and you refuse to play ball, most likely they're gonna back up, drop out, or change their game plan. But the courts are absolutely despicable. There's no honor in them whatsoever. There's no truth in them. I reported to the courts that they were teaching a class at a halfway house called Deep Black. And the class, you couldn't make this up, and it's hard to believe, but this class, Deep Black, was teaching inmates that the CIA and Mossad were running drug trafficking operations from the 1950s on, when they went in and took over the French Indochina area through the 60s and 70s. And that's the class syllabus right there, Deep Black. And this is what I took out of a halfway house, and it's the CIA's Secret Drug Wars by David Guyatt, 1997. It's a two-part series. They sit down inmates in a federal Justice Department halfway house and teach them this class. Now, mind you, these inmates have been in prison for 25 years, most of them. They've lost everything. They've lost their families, their homes, their life, their identity, a lot of it for drugs. And now they're being told that their government is doing exactly what they were put into jail for. What kind of reaction is that going to cultivate? I would say rebellion, anger, hatred, and all of the domestic uproar that warrants the police state existing in the first place. So they're seeding rebellion and chaos by teaching these inmates who can't spell cat that CIA and Mossad have been running drug operations and killing people who don't play ball. So you're in jail because you didn't do it right, or you weren't part of their team, or, you know, all this other stuff. Now they say it like, well, you know, we all have to gather together, and we have to know the government's not on our side. But it's hard to even get your head around this, because it's the government teaching this to inmates. This isn't the Boy Scouts or a church having a Bible study. This is the federal government in the Department of Justice halfway house teaching federally incarcerated inmates before they get home. You go through this class called Deep Black, and it's to brainwash you into the whole CIA drug operation culture. Now, I reported this to the Florida federal court. I said, this class is either a lie or it's true. If it's a lie, you need to shut it down and prosecute these people for brainwashing inmates. If it's true, the court needs to immediately investigate this and file a congressional complaint and demand that Congress looks at this. Because
now,
it's true.
You've come on to a good point there, demanding that Congress look at something. Let's just have a look now at a video clip taken from, of all places, the Alex Jones Show. I think it was earlier this week, Monday, I think. Bob Barr. Let's see what Bob Barr has to say.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because despite all of the problems, despite the massive bureaucracies we're dealing with in the area of intelligence, part of the problem is we have way too much bureaucracy, and both the prior Bush administration and this administration has continued to fund and expand this huge bureaucracy. That's part of the problem. Who do we, the people, fight? Where exactly is the problem? You know, you go after one agency, one provision, then you find out another agency is doing the same thing, but has power over the first agency. You know, it used to be that the CIA was formed to provide a single focus point for all foreign intelligence analysis and operations coming to the President of the United States. Well, never worked that way, because president after president, Republican and Democrat, wouldn't stand up to the bureaucracy over at the Pentagon and really back the CIA. Now it's far worse, because we have something called the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence. So trying to put your finger on exactly what the problem is so that we can hold the government accountable has become extremely difficult. And to be honest with you, the oversight function, the oversight responsibility of the Congress, particularly the House, they have fallen flat on their faces. They have some good people. Chaffetz, who heads the House Oversight Committee, is good. He's aggressive. He's smart. Yet the leadership has not seen fit to give him the power that he really needs to get to the bottom of these investigations.
What's the inside baseball on Benghazi? I mean, I know my perspective on it.
Okay, now Bob Barr is right on the money there. He's telling the American people that you can rein in a government, And you can do it with Congress. You can do it with congressional hearings. I can't remember the date of the first congressional hearing on the executive government, but the idea of having a fully legally constituted congressional committee that is a government oversight and reform body, which can do something about the executive when it goes terribly, terribly wrong, that is a very, very good thing. And someone like Jason Chaffetz, for example, I've watched Jason, and he is either going to beat people or he's going to get defeated himself, but he is right on the money. I've seen him obviously in the IRS hearings, in the OPM and Secret Service hearings. You can't pull the wool over Jason's eyes. Jason is a pretty sharp sort of character. Now, there are other people, obviously, Micah from Florida, who's been on these congressional hearings a long time. And where you have bipartisan support, Elijah Cummings, too, is a very, very powerful man. I think there are probably a dozen people on this particular committee, the Government Oversight and Reform, that are really good men, but only direct their efforts through this committee. Now, this is going to be extremely annoying to people like us who think that you should be able to simply write to your congressman and get something done. But I'm finding, and I can't tell you about this directly, but I'm finding that if the information gets through to this committee, things do seem to get done. Now, one of their favorites for dragging into these committee hearings was no less than Eric Holder. And I think this next clip, if you're ready there, Chance, video clip number two, I think this one is against Mr. Holder.
Before the gentleman yields back, the concern here is that Mr. Meadows first made his request in March of last year. And the reason you're here is we still don't have this information. That's why you have Ms. Lummis, Mr. Meadows, this whole committee frustrated. Do you understand that?
I certainly understand that. I appreciate that. I admit completely that our production has not been fast enough, and we will continue. We will do better.
Just turn on the photocopier.
We can't. It doesn't work that way. The search process doesn't work that way.
You have these materials enough so to make a rule, but you don't have the somebody comes to the conclusion they've looked at all the information, now they're going to make a rule. We want to see that information. I got
to
ask.
And I have committed that we will work to get you that. I am here to help. I want to be helpful.
We're about results. You're a very nice person. We're not seeing the results of it. Now, I got to ask you one other thing and follow up with Mr. Meadows. You've cited a couple of times that there are different stakeholders, and that's causing some delay. That you mentioned litigation, ongoing litigation. What in the world does that have to do with Congress's right to review documents?
With any document research, different equities are given the opportunity to review to make sure that there isn't sensitive matter that we're not aware of that is sensitive before it's turned over. That's our standard practice.
So what is it that you believe Congress shouldn't look at?
We haven't said that anything shouldn't be turned over.
I can't think of anything that OMB's...
We haven't said no to turning anything over.
Then why not give us everything?
We're working on that. It's an incredibly broad subpoena. 9 years.
And you give us handfuls of documents, and you just photocopy and give it to us.
The time that we were most successful in providing documents to you was when we had a conversation with your staff about what you wanted, and you asked for emails from the administrator. We've been asking for meetings with your staff, and until yesterday, they weren't available to meet
with
us. Oh,
that is not true. That is absolutely not true. You're infuriating in this. As nice and sweet as you want to portray yourself, this is infuriating. This request came in March, and here we are turning the new year. I'm going to ask you one more time, and then we'll go to Mr. Cartwright. Appreciate the committee's indulgence. Articulate for me what you believe Congress should not see.
We have not said that you can't see anything. There has been no document that we haven't given you that we've looked at.
There's no Then why not give it to us? Have you given us all the documents since March?
I have said that the document request is still outstanding. I have said that I will work with you to get you them more and to get faster. I cannot do more than that.
Yeah, you can. You actually can, and you're not. We're now going to recognize Mr. Cartwright from Pennsylvania for a generous 5 minutes.
Now, there we are, Scott. We clearly see a government official, an administrator, trying to frustrate the working of the committee. Now, we had this with Holder, with Fast and Furious. We had this with Koskinen in the IRS. Now, a letter went from this same committee to Obama requesting that Koskinen be removed from office, and it was refused. So, in effect, government oversight of government by the Congress is being frustrated, but it is there as a very useful and public way to expose the bad things about the executive. Now, you'll note there that the person who was speaking, Ms. Funisil, I think her name was, she spends a further quarter of an hour saying to other congressmen and women these same excuses. They're totally unbelievable. And there really needs to be a teeth power for Congress. Now, at the moment, we had Holder, who was held in contempt of court, your first attorney general in the history of the United States, as far as I know, and I'm not an expert on these things, I'm just some idiot sitting in Australia, but he was the first attorney general of the United States to be held in contempt of Congress. Now, my understanding was, once again, I'm not an expert, but my understanding was that there should have been a grand jury appointed and there should have been a trial on that basis. And there was not. There was also contempt by Lois Lerner. The same thing should have occurred there. It did not. I think what you need for Congress is possibly what we have in Australia, which is the Australian contempt power, where the legislature can actually enforce people who do not give information. They can bring them into the chamber in chains and have them imprisoned until they purge their contempt of a parliament, not a contempt of a court, but a contempt of a parliament. I think probably Congress needs something along these lines. But all too often, I think people are going to look at what doesn't happen. They're not going to watch these congressional hearings, and they're not going to understand the amount of obfuscation and delay and direct, well, in the case of Koskinen, let's just say direct deceit that is spent on these hearings. Probably the worst one I've seen was the Hillary one, where she simply would not say that she was to blame. When everything else said she was, she wouldn't say it. Now, the problem there, of course, was that the hearing was not bipartisan. And when you have someone like Hillary, obviously what you're going to have is just hiding Democrats, protecting Democrats. What comments have you got about this kind of thing that happens, Scott, just before we get to the top of the hour?
I can say with authority, because I was there and I did it, I reported material to Jason Chavitz. I reported material to Saxby Chambliss, and they did nothing. They didn't respond in any way. So I have a degree of skepticism about their honor, their integrity, their intelligence, or their efficiency. There's always a chance they never saw it, but that still falls into their inefficiency, because I know for a fact things were mailed to them. Now there's always a chance that CIA or other forces have went in and intercepted materials that I sent, but that even more condemns them for interfering with national security issues, because what I reported was a national security issue and still is a national security issue, given the shenanigans that we have been cultivating in Libya and now Syria. So the Congress, I think, is afflicted with the old man syndrome and the obsession to make decisions based on political calculus and career forecasts. It's not about the Constitution. It's not about law. It's not about what's right or wrong. It's not about what is in the best interest of my constituents. It's about, how do I use this to maximize my power, to get me another committee, to defeat an opponent, to guarantee more donors for my election, and they take into all this consideration and calculate whether or not to look at something or talk about something or to have a hearing on something. And that is what needs to be rectified, in a similar instrument that you're describing, where Congress has sort of teeth in its power. There needs to be an equivalent to have teeth over the members of Congress who refuse to address these issues and redress the grievances that people bring to them. And the only way to do it that I know so far is to file a civil suit in a court and sue them.
Well, let me just stop you there, because I've got a little clip now to show you, a very short clip, 5 minutes, which I think you will enjoy. File number 5, please, Chance. Just before we go to the hour break, have a listen to this and see if this doesn't bring warmth to the cockles of your heart.
Florida, Mr. DeSantis for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kadzik, the chairman, and myself sent a letter to the Justice Department in December requesting the case file for the prosecution of Dinesh D'Souza. We asked for it by the end of the month. We have not received it, which is obviously not a surprise given what people have said during this hearing. But I just wanted to ask you, will the department produce the case file?
We're willing to come and brief on the issue. Presenting prosecution files presents particular law enforcement sensitivities. I know that the issue that that you and the chairman are interested in is whether or not there was selective prosecution.
Among others, I mean, there are a number of issues that we would like to review and conduct oversight about how the case was handled. And, we want to get prompt responses. We don't want this to turn into the IRS or some of the other investigations that have just been stonewalled to death. So the case is over. There's no ongoing investigation. The sentence, I think, has even been served. So clearly we have a public interest in conducting oversight over how the department's doing its job. I mean, we fund your agency, and I think that we're entitled to the file. So we don't want a briefing, we want the file. So are you going to produce the file?
I'll be happy to take that back, and we'd be happy to brief. But as I indicated, there are particular law enforcement and prosecutorial sensitivities
such as
providing a case file. Well, there's the names of witnesses. There's individuals who cooperated with the investigation might not be publicly disclosed. There's the internal deliberations of the prosecutors that are deliberative and subject to the.
So basically, if a prosecutor did have illicit motivation and file, we're not entitled to that. So the public's never going to be able to know whether someone had ill intent when they were providing a case. Is that what you're saying?
No, that's not what I'm saying. And in fact, that issue.
And how would we discover the truth?
As that issue was raised before the court, and the court said that the defense did not provide any evidence of selective prosecution.
Because the defense also did not have access to what we're trying to seek access to. I mean, you know, it was, I understand in the middle of a case how you would say that there's attorney work product because there's an adversarial, we have an adversarial system, you start getting into strategy, and then that's just not the way our system functions. But that ship sailed. I mean, the case is over, in the books, prosecute, felony, serve the sentence. So that whole argument really is gone at this point. The interest is done. Is it your view that you talk about law enforcement sensitivities? Does that trump a subpoena from the Congress? Because if we don't get the case file, obviously, through the request, then we may issue a subpoena from the committee.
As I said, we would like to find a way to accommodate the committee and provide it with the information that it needs. I think the first step in that process would be a briefing so that you can ask questions and receive information, and then we can see what other further accommodations may be necessary.
When can you let us know what the department's position on the file is? I'm not even asking when you could produce it, although I assume the Department of Justice still employs interns who could easily make the copies. When are you going to let us know? You said you're going to take it back and talk to people. So when are you going to be able to respond to the committee one way or another?
I think we can respond to that within the next 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay. Well, I mean, I don't think it should take 3 weeks. I mean, I think that we would like to have an answer, you know, towards the third week of this month. And if we don't get that, then we're going to continue to press the issue, because I look around, I hear the stories, and, you know, at the end of the day, it's not members of Congress who are ultimately being stonewalled on a lot of this stuff. It's the American people, because our constituents ask us about things. We have constituents who were targeted by the IRS. Some of us have constituents who were in other situations, and they come and they see a government that's just totally unresponsive, and a government that's very difficult to get answers from. And I don't think that's really the way the system was designed. So we will await that response, and obviously we will be in contact one way or another after that. I yield back the balance of my time.
Now, that's the sort of thing one wants to hear in the face of truculent administrative officers who are simply trying to hide a criminal file against Dinesh D'Souza in this case, for a prosecution that was taken probably quite spitefully, I should think, quite maliciously. There are hundreds of thousands of offences that were far worse than Dinesh D'Souza's that were not prosecuted for. But why Dinesh? Well, my experience of Dinesh was that he just argued with, as far as I know, I think he's a Republican, but a Republican Christian, and I think he has some good arguments with Christopher Hitchens. That's my experience of Dinesh. I don't see him as a threat to the electoral system, and I certainly don't see him as someone who deserved a year in jail for simply paying $20,000 too much into the Republican Party coffers. What's your view on that, Scott?
Well, I think they came after Dinesh, yeah, because he was a conservative, because he was Indian, and you want to take him out of the mix so he can't give a non-white face to the Republican Party. They reacted with a tyrannical Gestapo, you know, prosecution of him. However, keep in mind, Dinesh D'Souza took a plea deal. John Curacao took a plea deal. When you take a plea deal, you're sacrificing yourself on the altar, and you have no recourse. I never took a plea deal. Susan Lindauer never took a plea deal. We fought, and that's what has given us the chance for a second bite of the apple. It takes 2 years, 3 years before you can get it in front of a court again. And as my case, they've been running away from this every chance they get. They've been hiding documents from me. They've been pretending to have sent me documents, and they never do. And they've done so many countermeasures. It's almost like, you know, the hunt for Red October. They're throwing out these big bubbling countermeasures in the hope the torpedo is not going to find them. But I'm still tracking them, and I'm still moving forward, getting closer and closer and closer to the day where I go into a courtroom and say, it's been a couple years and you've denied every motion, but I am raising this on the constitutional grounds that you're violating every military officer's rights by what you did to me. And it was never known. It was never brought out. It was never put into the courtroom. So I am exercising my constitutional right to file an ineffective assistance of counsel 2255, which every person can do who's been prosecuted and feel that prosecution and the charge was injustice. It shouldn't have happened. It was a conflict of law, and somehow a mistake was made.
But and, given that you have to correct things for yourself,
yeah,
it's not everybody in the world, not every public person who looks at a law report. But some people, more people, do look at congressional hearings. Then, of course, we have the aspect of whether the mainstream media will take anything that comes from one of these congressional hearings. But I think that's probably the only chance we've got. They certainly don't report on individual court cases such as you're bringing, unless they want to, usually, demonize the plaintiff in your case.
Well, that's exactly what they did to me. They demonized me, but I kept getting them at every turn. I found myself in the positions and in the agencies because I was so embedded in the establishment. I was so embedded in the Republican Party and the defense contracting and the military and the intelligence circles. They couldn't believe that I was in all of these locations where all of this stuff happened. And it kept them off their balance. And the only thing they could do was try and demonize me and make up all sorts of fantasies and stories. And it was all utter lies and completely ridiculous. The CIA even tried to get involved and try and, they wrote a false affidavit claiming that I had been snuck onto a military base to get my hair cut and things that were just so ludicrous. And I couldn't believe it. But this was the government doing these things. And, I went through it and I lived it. But because
it really got to that, that they were looking for things like you sneaking onto a base to get a military haircut to impugn your character.
Yeah. And it's like, of course this was not me and I didn't do that. I'm a military officer. I can go onto a military base anytime I want. I don't need to dress up as a policeman to get onto a military base. What kind of asinine. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I could not believe. I thought, they got to be making a mistake. They can't be this stupid. But they weren't. They were purposely trying to do it. They were violating the law, violating my civil rights, and just hoping that I would go away, that I would drop it, that I wouldn't keep a documented record of every bad thing that they did with the intention of taking all of that back at some point and throwing it on the table like a dead cat in front of a judge somewhere saying, these bastards have violated every right and every constitutional issue that made this country America, and I'm reporting it to you, Judge, and you better damn well have them brought in irons to answer and probably be put to prison, if not shot for treason, because this has a lot of global implications. Benghazi, Brad Birkenfeld was paid off $104 million on the same exact day as Benghazi. So all of the money that
seems a really strange coincidence, doesn't it?
Extremely strange. And everyone.
And when we throw in the fact that there was probably an arms deal going on at the same day.
Yeah.
That's
all of that.
Now Chance is going to give us someone from the chat has got, I think, a question. Have they, Chance?
Yeah, they just had a comment/question for Scott. They're basically asking, would it not be safer for Scott to release documents or his information into the public realm instead of kind of going through official channels trying to basically ask the belly of the beast to look at themselves? Would it not be safer to kind of release the documents and then maybe pursue all your legal angles, or is there something restricting you, or what are your thoughts on that? They basically are saying they would hate to see another whistleblower go missing before anything can be brought about of this.
Yeah, well, I've released everything that is necessary in Shell Game, and nothing is classified. Everything in Shell Game, which you can find by Googling it, by Shell Game by Scott Bennett, it's available on lulu.com, L-U-L-U.com. Every document is up there, and my whole analysis is up there, and that was the very report that went to Congress. Now, I do have other materials that I do not release because they are more of my insurance policy for, hey, if you really want to try and come down upon me, I'll have people that have safely taken documents and materials that were given to me by various people and sources, and I'll make sure those are released. Those are sort of keeping your ace cards up your sleeve. But the body and the bulk of the request for discussion, the request for a hearing, are all contained in the whistleblowing report Shell Game. And no one, I did it for a reason. I let it out into the public after I first sent it to the military, sent it to the Congress in 2012, when it was clear they were not wanting to do anything about it. I released it in 2013. And I released it with a very clear chain of command. I'm releasing this material. If you have any objection, let me know. No response, no objection, nothing. So I released it in 2013 to more media and to congressmen and senators and everyone that I could. to say, if the Congress isn't going to act and the military is not going to act, the Inspector General of the Pentagon is not going to act, then I'm going to get it out to the American people. And that's why I put it all together in one single book that's up on the web. And it's, you can get it a PDF or hard copy. It's at cost. And just Google Shell Game by Scott Bennett. And that will arm you with the knowledge of every senator and every congressman and every act of corruption and denial that they've done for the since 2012. It exposes the connection to Hillary Clinton and Eric Holder and Lanny Breuer. It connects Edward Snowden to Brad Birkenfeld, Snowden's lawyer, Jesselyn Raddick, and she was connected to Birkenfeld. Birkenfeld's $104 million payoff on Benghazi on the same day as Benghazi. So the interconnection of Benghazi. In fact, I wrote and contacted and phone called Trey Gowdy and all of the members who were examining Benghazi. And I said, you need to look at this because it's part of your...
Just there a minute, Scott. If you sent something to Trey Gowdy, if it's relevant, it's highly unlikely that it's been ignored. But there is a hearing going on, and he would not be able to comment on those documents if they were relevant to the hearing, either in public or to you while the hearing was ongoing. Now, we have to, unfortunately, break there. If you can stay with us after the break, Scott, we'd be very, very grateful. But I understand you've got possibly to rush away for something.
Yeah, I've got a medical thing I've got to attend to, but it's been an honor to be with you, Alan. We'll do it again.
You betcha we will. Thanks very much indeed, Scott.
Thank you, buddy.
Less than 3% of you people read books, but less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets, turn them off now, turn them off and leave them off.
Now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
We'll be right back.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
Now we're back, and thank you very much for Scott coming along to have a chat with us about his particular travails with the executive branch of American government over the last couple of years. And let's make no mistake, the initial problem that arose for Scott was that as he was going out of his place of work, he was accused of being drunk. He requested that some form of breathalyzer or other blood sample or whatever be taken. That didn't happen. The next thing they came up with was he was a military officer and he had firearms on the base that he shouldn't have had. That was dropped. And the final thing that came up was his civilian prosecution, not a military prosecution, but a civilian prosecution for placing the wrong circles on a government form. Now, I don't think this was a question of a heinous fraud along the lines of the frauds that Scott has been talking about. But nonetheless, the Department of Justice took issue with him, and he ended up in jail for a year. Now, there's been a problem throughout the reign of Eric Holder as the Attorney General. We're going to look at that shortly, but first of all, I'd like chance to tell you about, first let me just put this into perspective. We had a bit of a run-in with Rebecca Roth, and one of the channels got taken off YouTube, and so a backup channel now is running, but there's also other broadcast that we don't mention enough where you can go to find basically everything that's on NBC, Real Media, and a lot of it is really worth looking at, believe me. I've got my own show coming up shortly, which of course I'm now banging the gong for, called Nothing But the Truth, and our kickoff is a show with none other than Kelly Watt, the only lady that I know of who actually got to talk with a character called Lenny Posner. Now, those of you who are familiar with the Sandy Hook hoax are going to know the name Lenny Posner very, very well. Now, over on that other channel, you'll be able to find shortly an interview, an hour interview, I think hour and 15 minutes, interview with Kelly Watt on this chap, Posner, and what we can gauge from her speech with him, with her talks with him. But right of now, Chance, if you could come in and tell us about these other ways to watch the stuff that we put on NBC, please.
Well, basically, the best place to look for all your links and all of the simplest one-touch solutions is just go to MediaBroadcastingCenter.com. It has the original link to the YouTube. It has the new YouTube backup channel. It has a thing called like a third-party site that isn't YouTube. We upload high-def videos to. It does get lots of views on that channel, and we are able to put things on there that get ripped off of YouTube, and they don't get taken down. So if you go to the MediaBroadcastingCenter.com, it has all the links for everything. There's also a blog up there that I write articles and post some things up that people could also contribute to, or they could Just look through some of the material. I've got a story up there with the link for Jim Fetzer's Sandy Hook download up there, so people can get that for free. And just as a side note, I noticed that Jim has his new book on Boston released right now. And hopefully when he's back...
I'm in that. I've not seen that book, but I'm in there somewhere.
Yeah. When he gets back on Monday, we'll be able to get some comments, I'm sure, on it. That'll be some upcoming shows on Boston. But I have my Truth Talk show coming back out. We have a number of other shows on the network. And all of these are on MediaBroadcastingCenter.com. If you're just looking for the Jim Fetzer Real Deal show, and you've been checking out the YouTube channel that's been suspended, the shows are still there. I just can't upload. I can't make certain changes to the channel. I can't do thumbnails, that type of thing. So the shows are still there. And I was able to create a playlist called The Real Deal. There's about 150-some-odd episodes on the video portion on there.
And let's just say, let me just cut in there, because some of those Real Deal programs are absolute crackers. The one with Roger Stone, for example, I must have listened to that 5 or 6 times now. The Larry Nichols. Some of the other ones are fairly esoteric material that simply wouldn't get a play elsewhere. So it's a great story.
I think he even had me on twice. I think so.
What were you talking about there, Charles?
I did a JFK one with him about the Freemasons' involvement.
Oh, yeah, that's right, the 33 levels. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, that was pretty interesting, too.
Now, when you're on this actual playlist for Jim, because this is what a lot of people are coming to, like that's the main channel for the YouTube, because it's a playlist, I'm adding them from the new channel. So if you're used to coming to the NBC playlist and looking for Jim shows, you don't even have to go anywhere. I'm linking them from there. But you'll notice they're uploaded from a different name. It'll say NBC backup channel. Click subscribe, because who knows how long all of these little platforms are going to be. We all know that YouTube is basically compromised and censoring people actively. Channels are being deleted. People are being suppressed. Live shows are being cut off. If you put the wrong comment
I've
up.
I've noticed, Chance, that often when I do battle with government ops on some of the posts, all of their posts simply disappear.
Now, I've tried to comment to people on the YouTube channel about what's going on there on my end. Now, I don't delete a comment. I don't do anything. There's no censorship on our end. I don't care if people disagree. I like to see them battling back. Sometimes you get some really good comments out of it. You might even get led down a rabbit hole you never even knew. So we generally tend to leave the comments, so unless there's like an obvious, you know, attacking someone or something like that that's terrible.
So who is removing all of these comments?
Well, get this. Every single day I have to go into the video manager. I go into the part where it says community, and then I go to where it says comments. Now, every single day it'll say 300 comments removed to spam. And then you look at the spam, and you just go in there, and you click approve, and they all get approved. But you're seeing them posted on YouTube. They are getting published on YouTube, but then automatically they're going to this big folder that are all gone. So if I didn't actively go in there and check, there'd just be thousands and thousands of comments gone. Because every day there's hundreds of them.
So, in fact, worthwhile comments can not go on the post and go into this big spam folder of yours.
Yes, exactly. Now,
that's not very efficient, is it? Really?
It is if you're the New World Order power structure and you're running a YouTube.
I didn't mean it in that sense. I didn't mean
it sucks for us, yes, and for the commenters and for all that. But I mean, for how they're filtering us out of what's going on, yeah, that's something that happens. I can actually show you on screen with a little bit of what's happening here.
Yeah, sure, do. Let's have a look.
Let me go right into the community. Okay, so
now I'll just give another plug for my interview with Kelly Watt. I think she's quite an important character, being the only person that I know of who's actually spoken to Lenny Posner and can recognize his voice I think the interview will bring out some surprising things for some people. Are we there now, Charles?
Yeah, I've got up on screen for people. I'm just trying to see if I can get you included into this so you can get a screen share.
Well, now that's okay. Just explain what you have for the viewers.
Oh, I think I should be able to get you in here. Here we go. You're in the screen share as well.
No. Here we go. Yes.
Okay, so on screen for people, I'm just going into the community on the dashboard, and it's going to show me right here. I haven't touched anything. Likely spam, 138 comments. So this is just since I've touched this today earlier. There's 138 comments that automatically get booted into this likely spam folder.
Yeah.
So that's basically when, from that moment there, you just click on it, and it shows how they're all down there, and you'll probably find yourself in there a lot of times.
I did. I just saw something about me saying we need a new YouTube, a new Skype, yeah, and a new email.
So here's what we do. We just click approve. We just check all of them, and bam, they're all gone up to there. Now, you've got to kind of click back and forth to make sure they're all gone. It says that, you know, maybe most of them are up.
This is a complete waste of time for you, isn't it?
Well, it's something that, like, not only that, but our messages have the same basic thing happening, where if you send a message privately to our YouTube channel, sometimes you end up with this exact same scenario where they're all getting bounced into the spam folder, and then I don't see it to pass it on to Jim or our other hosts.
Yeah. Well, anyway, let's go back to this character, Eric Holder, now, and let's have a look at this file. This is 11 minutes long, but it's certainly worth
watching. Number 7.
File 7, please, Charles. And perhaps if you could, comment on it afterwards.
The gentleman from California, Mr. Ice, is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be remiss if I didn't take exception to calling the NRA members, the millions of them, radicals. I think that's an offensive statement beneath contempt in this committee. Mr. Attorney General, will you agree to come before the Oversight Committee without the need for a subpoena in the January timeframe? I will not. Mr. Attorney General, will you agree to come before the committee I chair, the Oversight Committee, the one you produced these documents to, in the January timeframe without the need for a subpoena?
I will consider it, but I will note I've testified on four occasions with regard to this matter. I've appeared before you at least on two occasions.
You've appeared before this committee. Your organization pushed back on the request for a joint hearing here today. Not will you consider it, but do I need to serve a subpoena on yourself and Lanny Brewer and the other people under direct investigation of my committee, or will you agree to come voluntarily in the January timeframe before the committee?
I will consider any request that you make.
I thank you, Mr. Attorney General. I now would go to questions of emails. This is the documents you refer to. Most of these documents, 5,000 or so, are in fact emails. Mr. Attorney General, I have a question for you. Not one of these emails, in fact, is yours. Aren't you a prolific emailer?
No.
Don't you email?
Yes.
Do you have a personal email account and as well as a Attorney General's email account?
I have an email account at the Justice Department, yes.
Do you have a personal email?
Yes.
Do you regularly email to Lanny Brewer, your former partner, and your head of criminal division?
No, I wouldn't say regularly. There are only a limited number of people who know my email address in the Justice Department.
Let me cut to the chase. Don't you think it's a little conspicuous in his absence that there's not one email to or from you related to Fast and Furious in any way, shape, or form?
There are a variety of reasons why the emails that we have shared with you are there. We have shared in an unprecedented way email information that no Justice Department, no Attorney General has ever authorized before. You have deliberative information contained, I guess.
But isn't it true that executive privilege does not flow to the Attorney General, only to the office of the President? So deliberative process within your department running law enforcement, in fact, doesn't serve executive privilege. As the chairman said going on, you haven't cited any reason that these would not have been delivered.
In making production determinations, we have followed what attorneys general in the past have always used as applicable standards, and these are Republican as well as Democratic attorneys general, and the information that we have provided to you has been responsive, has been, I think, fulsome, and also has been unprecedented.
Well, unprecedented would be an attorney general who knew nothing about something where his own DAG, now his present chief of staff, was intimately familiar. Gary Grindler was well aware, according to documents provided, of Fast and Furious on March 12, 2010. Are you aware of that, that he was aware of Fast and Furious and what its procedures were on March of 2010?
It was certainly brought to his attention as part of a regular briefing that he got from ATF, but he did not hear during that briefing anything about the tactics.
Really? Is that why in his own handwriting, when he talks about going to stash houses, he clearly understood in a document you've delivered, he clearly understood in his own handwriting what the tactic was. But I'm going to ask you a different question. He understood. Look,
can I answer that question?
You've answered it less than truthfully.
Chairman, could the questioner allow the witness to answer the question?
Madam, this is my time. I am not yielding.
I'm not asking
madam,
to yield.
The gentleman from California, Mr. Isaac, has the time.
I understand
has the time.
That.
The gentlewoman from Texas has
I'd
not been
I'd appreciate it if the witness could be allowed to answer
from
the
Texas,
question, Mr.
The
Chairman.
The gentleman from Texas has not been recognized.
I ask for a sense of protocol here.
The gentleman from California has the time.
Mr. Attorney General, as I was saying, Mr. Grindler, you can't ask or answer on his behalf, and so it makes no sense to. This is evidence that was delivered. Do you regularly talk to your chief of staff, and do you regularly receive oral briefings from Mr. Grindler, and, in fact, when you made the decision to have him be the DAG and then the chief of staff, wouldn't it be reasonable to assume that if he knew on March 10th, as this document indicates, that you would also know? March 12th of 2010.
First, he was not made intimately familiar with the program as a result of that briefing. The briefing that he received from then acting director Melson did not go into the tactics. Melson indicated.
Of course, it didn't. It didn't go into the tactics, Mr. Chairman. I'd ask that I have the time restored that I lost with the lady's interruption.
The gentleman is recognized for an additional minute, and also. To give the opportunity to the Attorney General to respond to the question.
I certainly look forward to that. Mr. Attorney General.
I was in the middle of an answer, I think.
You know, you're in the middle of filibustering, I'll let you answer. I have two more things to quickly go over, and then you can have all the time the chairman will give you. Does it surprise you that these boxes, five boxes, represent just what one gun dealer gave us voluntarily? Well, in fact, this seems to be all the information you have responsive to our subpoena. Does it cause you to think that, in fact, we believe you are withholding documents? We believe that, in fact, there is more production. So my final question, and you can answer all of them for as long as the chairman wants, is do you today have documents responsive to the lawful request of the Oversight Committee that have not yet been granted?
All right, well, let me go back to my first answer that I was not...
Well, mine's pretty easy. Mine's a yes or no, and then the others you're going to go on for a while.
I'll get to that.
Would you please get to it first?
Gary Grindler, he was not provided with a detailed analysis of Fast and Furious. He was given information about
I asked earlier that the Attorney General be placed under oath. I was denied that. But what I will make the point is that it is not productive for anyone to come before this committee and tell us what somebody else didn't know. That is exactly how the legislative liaison behind the Attorney General, Mr. Weish, came and gave false testimony to my committee, false because people who are still working for the Attorney General knowingly gave him misleading information in addition to the U.S. Attorney, and no action has been taken. I might note for the record that the IG...
I have a parliamentary inquiry, Mr. Chairman.
The gentleman from California continues to be recognized, and let me make a point in the record.
that he is not over time near as much as the gentlewoman from Texas was a few minutes ago. So let's
I thank you for your courtesy, but I would like to understand whether the gentleman has extended time.
And he was recognized for that purpose, as the Attorney General will be recognized for the purpose of responding.
And will he allow the Attorney General to answer the question?
I look forward to it.
Thank you. Thank you very much, my colleague.
Mr. Chairman, I'll use only five more seconds. The fact is the Inspector General has released information that was secret to the object of our investigation with the knowledge of the Justice Department. She is not currently, in our opinion, qualified to investigate and, in fact, has overstepped the line by delivering secret tapes to the object of our investigation. Well, the Justice Department was slow rolling that discovery, and this is the ATF agent that was intimately involved with this.
Okay.
So I want you to understand, I have treated this Attorney General as a hostile witness because ultimately, when it comes before us saying he's going to clean house, no house has been cleaned.
Gentlemen, time has expired, and the Attorney General will be given the opportunity to respond.
I'll try again. Gary Grindler was not provided with information, as you've described, intimate information about Operation Fast and Furious. He was not told about the tactics that were used there. The person who did the briefing was the acting head of ATF, and he has, I understand, testified before your committee that he did not, in fact, share that tactical information with Mr. Grindler. I note that Mr. Melson also briefed you, Congressman, about a month or so later, before, I forget which, and he said at that time he did not share with you information about those tactics. So the notion or your contention that Gary Grindler was familiar with this or intimately familiar with this is inconsistent with what I think the facts are, and you take me to task for trying to assume what I know Grindler to have said. You have not interviewed him as well, and nevertheless, you feel comfortable doing the same thing. With regard to the documents that you talked about, we have not withheld any documents that are responsive to the matters that you have asked us about. We have withheld information that pertains to ongoing investigations. That is the thing that might have limited our document production. But again, what we produced on February the 4th is unlike anything that any committee in any part of this Congress, Senate or House, has ever seen before. And I want to make clear, as we said in that letter, that is not precedential. I'm not holding, and I don't think any future Attorney General should be expected to do that, but given the nature of what we did in withdrawing that February 4th letter, it seemed to me to make sense to make an exception to what has been a long-recognized rule.
Mr. Chairman, could the AG be allowed to fully answer, since it was pursuant to a subpoena, whether or not his answer about did he provide
the gentleman's time
means
has expired.
He was withholding or not withholding, he didn't answer.
Does the Attorney General wish to add anything?
Mr. Chairman, that would require unanimous consent. I withhold.
The gentlewoman has not been recognized. I was asking the Attorney General a question. Does the Attorney General wish to respond any further to the questions?
I'm fine.
Okay.
Apparently my mic's been on mute the whole time I've been talking. Just to reiterate for anyone who missed my little spiel that I had while I was on mute. I'm back here in the control panel. Sometimes you don't notice these things. But basically, it's a lot of bullshit going on. It's just backpedaling and sidestepping until he knows his time's up and he can just basically, you know, give pre-statements that are authorized. There's no way we're going to one of these little meetings and seeing the truth come out. Like, he just said in the beginning of the clip, he wasn't allowed to be under oath, or he wasn't going to be under oath. So he can lie now, and then he's saying, you know, I'll get to that later, or he's saying, well, I need a yes or no. Well, I'll get to that later, and then here's what this guy says, or here's what the, you know... I couldn't give that answer in my day job in a meeting, let alone a person in front of a congressional committee. Like, what's going on? Well, like, just throw one of these people in jail just one time.
Yeah, wouldn't it? If you think that process is a bit unwieldy and gives no results, what do you think of this process where you can be called before a government body and actually be put in chains because you won't answer truthfully? We have that procedure in Australia. It's called contempt of federal parliament. Now, that can be and has been done in the past. Now, that might be something that congressmen might like to consider as being a worthy alternative to that 11 minutes of pure frustration that we just saw. Now, this is nothing out of the ordinary for Mr. Holder, and I think the next file, file number 6, shows that this is just business as usual for Eric Holder. If we can watch that one now, Charles.
Being here, have you spoken to Secretary Napolitano about Fast and Furious?
No.
Have you spoken with Secretary Clinton about Fast and Furious?
No.
Have you spoken to President Obama about Fast and Furious?
I don't think that I have. I see the President.
That's okay. If you haven't, you haven't. Have you spoken to the President of Mexico about Fast and Furious?
No.
Have you spoken to the Attorney General of Mexico about Fast and Furious?
I don't believe so.
You have routinely argued that you've been oblivious and disengaged in this operation, and I buy that to a large extent.
I'm not sure.
But we have a dead Border Patrol agent in Agent Terry. We have 2,000 missing guns. We have 200 deaths in Mexico. We had dead government officials in Mexico. We have a Mexican helicopter with troops in it that shot, three of which are wounded, back in May of this year. We have 50-plus members of Congress calling for your resignation over this, and you've never spoken to any one of these people about this operation.
First off, the notion that I am somehow oblivious to this matter is totally belied by these inconvenient things called the facts.
You took 5 days to go to the Caribbean. You didn't have 15 minutes to call Secretary Clinton, Napolitano, talk to the president or your counterparts in Mexico?
Understand something. With regard to Secretary Napolitano, our agencies have been in constant touch with each other about this issue because we are engaged, both of us, in the prosecution of the killer of...
Okay, so if you were intimately involved and engaged in this, remember, Agent Terry was killed in December, mid-December, and then we had Jaime Zapata, who was killed in Mexico, two officers shot February 15th. On February 16th, you and Secretary Napolitano issued a press release that's titled Secretary Napolitano and Attorney General Holder form a joint task force to assist Mexico's investigation into yesterday's shooting of two ICE agents in Mexico. At the very beginning of this press release, Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano and Attorney General Eric Holder today met to discuss this issue. And how is it that you and Secretary Napolitano said you never even talked or discussed, even brought up or had any discussion about Fast and Furious?
The press release that you talked about is not a Fast and Furious matter.
But
so the, and understand, yeah, you have to understand something, the way Washington works here, okay? The reality is that when it comes to matters that are under investigation.
But the death of Jaime Zapata was highly likely, it was highly likely that that came from Fast and Furious. In fact, from testimony that we took from Agent Forcelli, and I'm going to read from this, is from January 8th of 2011. Quote, and there was this sense, like every other time, even with Miss Gifford's shooting, there was a state of panic, like, oh my God, let's hope that this is not a weapon from that case. And the shooting of Mr. Zapata down, I know that, again, that state of panic that they had, like, please, let this not come back. So the agents on the ground were so concerned that this is going to happen. You and Secretary Napolitano have a discussion, and there's no discussion about even the possibility of Fast and Furious?
There is the meaningful conversations that happen between DHS and DOJ happen at lower levels, between investigators.
But when you and Secretary, what did you and Secretary Napolo talk about if you didn't talk about Fast and Furious, and it's the day after Jaime Zapata, and you were very quick to issue press releases?
Well, you're making an assumption that that, in fact, is a Fast and Furious case. I'm not sure that that...
We didn't know at the time. You didn't know at the time. I didn't know. Nobody knew at the time. Yeah. Isn't it a reasonable assumption to suggest that it may have been guns from Fast and Furious that happened, that caused that death?
Given the fact that there are, over the course of the last 5 years, 64,000 weapons that have gone from the United States to Mexico.
I have a hard time believing, Mr. Attorney General, with all due respect, my time is short. Twice the President of the United States has gone before the American people and said that you had nothing to do with this, you weren't involved in it, you weren't engaged in it, yet you said you've never spoken to the President. How is it that he would know that you haven't been involved, you weren't involved in this, and he could make such a claim if you've never even spoken to him about it?
Well, the president gets information from the Justice Department in a variety of ways. We interact with the White House counsel's office very frequently. I don't know exactly what the flow of information is within the White House, but he can find out about my state of involvement in matters connected to the Justice Department without speaking directly to
Let me move on to a you have access to, obviously, the emails of Dennis Burke. On Wednesday, November 24, 2010, he sent an email. It said, quote, some of the weapons bought by these clowns in Arizona have been directly traced to murders of elected officials in Mexico by the cartels. So, Katie, bar the door when we unveil this baby, end quote. How is it that you've never had a discussion with your counterpart in Mexico about this? In fact, in Los Angeles Times article dated September 19th of this year, quote, at no time did we know or were we made aware that there might have been arms trafficking permitted. In no way would we have allowed it because it is an attack on the safety of Mexicans. It goes on in the article, actually the paragraph before, and to this date she said U.S. officials have not briefed her on the operation gone awry, nor have they apologized. What is unacceptable is that you and everybody in your organization, according to you, the higher-ups know about this investigation. You don't have 15 minutes to pick up the phone, and we have still never talked to these people in order to solve this problem because, as you say, it's going to go on for some time.
We have taken steps. I have taken steps to solve this problem in that I've ordered an examination of this to determine exactly what happened. I have issued directives that this should never happen again. We have put in place measures at ATF so that this kind of thing won't happen again. What Todd Jones has done with regard to the reforms that he has put in place, I think, are going to be extremely effective. And I've made personnel changes with regard to...
You haven't fired anybody. Nobody's been fired.
The gentleman's time has expired. Does the gentleman want to respond to the last question?
I just was trying to say that I have made personnel changes with regard to the agencies that have been involved, and these are initial terminations that I have made. It is not all that I am possibly going to do. There is an impatience here. And in some ways I understand it, but the reality is that you have to do these things on the basis of evidence, on the basis of findings that are factually grounded, and when I am in that position, I will take the appropriate action. But I want to assure you and the American people that people will be held accountable for the mistakes that were made in Fast and Furious.
Okay. Well, more of the same. Much power to Jason Chaffetz for going that hard against what he knows is going to be a brick wall of denial, obfuscation, evasion, and basically deception. Eric Holder, as the chief legal officer of the United States, is going to be the person who can ask things of, certainly of the FBI, it may even be the ATF involved in Fast and Furious. There's another point, the proliferation of security agencies throughout America at the moment lends itself very, very well to obfuscating responsibility. You could have the situation where, for example, if Jason Chaffetz was talking only about the ATF, you could have comments other agencies or comments on other agencies by Holder that go unsaid because he would give selective answers. Holder's appointment seems to have been one of the worst political attorney general appointments in American history. And if we look at the record of what got attended to over his reign, we had banks that got fined, but none of their officers got prosecuted. We have soccer organizations being chased around for a bit of fraud here and there, and we still have no answer to Fast and Furious. We still have no responsibility within the American government for instigating the ridiculous, nonsensical plan to export firearms willingly to Mexico in order to trace them and catch the bad guys. Now, if someone like Holder can't see that doing that kind of thing is just a recipe for disaster. Sending guns across the border to Mexico, a country that already seems to be very like a third world nation with no enforceable law standards at all from what we see in the mainstream media. Sending more guns over and thinking that you can possibly trace them and make the big busts is nonsense, absolute nonsense. And as far as we know, the only people held responsible for the death of that agent are the ones that actually shot him, not the people who supplied the guns to walk over the border, just the actual murderers. I think in a way that there's a complicity there, but that complicity, of course, will never be prosecuted through the courts. Now, it's not often that you find a politician, and in this case an American congressman, summing up what's going on very, very well, and especially along the lines that Jason Chaffetz does it. But there is another little clip here that we've got, and we should watch this one now to find out what actually is going on in some of these hearings and the fact that these guys are not, these congressmen are not being hoodwinked. They're not simpletons. And if we could play now file four, please, Charles.
Mr. Palmer, 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Levin, on June 19th of last year, Senator Mark Warner's office, it may have been 2013, I think it was 2014, his office sent a letter to OPM questioning the nature of the agency's credit monitoring contract with Winville CSID. It appears from my records that his office received a reply 4 days later on June 23rd. However, when this committee sent a letter requesting information on the contract, the committee didn't receive a response until a month later, which incidentally was 17 days overdue. Now, what I want to know is what accounted for the extended time it took to respond to this committee versus the quick turnaround for Senator Warner's office? I mean, do we need to ask a senator to send a request for documents so that we can get a timely response for documents?
Thank you for the question, Congressman. I would note those prior to my arrival at OPM, but I'm aware of what you're inquiring about. So with respect to Senator Warner's letter, if I'm understanding correctly, two major differences. One, it was not a request for documents. I think it was a request for information, and we went and did brief out.
Provided a briefing. So parsing words?
No, absolutely not. The large distinction being Senator Warner asked for some information. We provided information to his staff in an oral fashion, similar to as we've done with committee staff.
Let me ask you this. Do you prioritize certain requests? Do you give more a higher priority to requests from certain individuals, elected officials, or agencies than you do others? And let me just tell you, I've sat here now an hour and a half, 2 hours, listening to this. Mr. Meadows from North Carolina and his discussion about the lack of response from the Office of Management and Budget. And, you know, I have to question whether or not you guys respect the constitutional authority that's invested in this committee. I mean, our responsibility is oversight. We owe that to the American people. And I've heard example after example today of how your agencies continue to impede this committee's ability to carry out our oversight responsibilities. It's, you know, there's a pattern here, Mr. Chairman. Before I was a member of Congress, before I was in this committee, there was a letter signed by 47 inspector generals. That's, I believe it's 47 out of 72. Is that correct, Mr. Chairman? In their letter, and I believe this is unprecedented, that the OIG's office felt like they had to send a letter to this committee because federal agencies were impeding investigations by withholding documents. It seems to me that that's what's continuing to happen right now. You know, if this were a Department of Justice, Mr. Kadzik, if the Department of Justice sent out a request for documents in an effort to do due diligence in investigating any issue, I doubt seriously that the Department of Justice would look very kindly upon the kind of delays that this committee has experienced. I dare say they might even issue a warrant. It would probably rise to the level of obstruction of justice. But what we've had to deal with here is delay after delay, and to delay is to obstruct, in my opinion. It seems to me that you're running out the clock. There have been numerous requests. Mr. Chairman, our chairman, has requested time and time again for dates certain for the production of documents. But it seems to me that you think, and it appears to me you've been very well coached in how to respond to these requests. It just appears to me, Mr. Chairman, that they have no intention of producing the documents. That is frustrating, and it's a violation of the public trust. I yield back.
Thank the gentleman. Now,
if that doesn't say it succinctly, you're running out the clock. This gentleman, Mr. Palmer, hasn't been in Congress very long, and he's a very honest voice. Obviously, he sees what's happening, and he's giving his honest opinion about it. He sat there before, how many was it? Five government agencies, including the Office of Personnel Management. Documents have been outstanding from congressional requests for up to a year in some cases, and the heads of those departments simply sit there and say, we are doing our best we can. We will look forward to doing what we can with you in the future. Now, we might remember earlier, this guy Kedzik was the chap who was trying to fend off the inquiry about Dinesh D'Souza. He certainly is running out the clock. As soon as Obama goes, that chap will be gone too. And the problem there is, of course, that once he's gone, he can't be subpoenaed for any documents because he simply has no control over any documents. In fact, retirement has become, for a lot of these department heads, the way out. They simply wash their hands of something by retiring. They retire with their full benefits. In cases, for example, of the Secret Service head, I'm sorry, her name escapes me at the moment, she was clearly incompetent. She retired the very next day after a congressional hearing. She retired with all benefits and simply passed the problems on to the next head of the Secret Service. There's no judgment of these people at all. And what the congressional committee is trying to do is to sit in both investigative and a judgmental role, but its judgment is limited to the recommendation of legislation. So you've got one half of the government, or rather one third of the government, the legislative body, which is saying to the executive body, look, do the right thing. And the executive half is simply saying, we can't perform consistently. We can't perform. It might be worth considering strengthening the powers of congressional investigation. And by the look of what's happened in America over the last 2-3 years, the things that have come to light through congressional inquiry, not through journalistic investigation, things like the OPM hack, the IRS hiding of emails, the import-export fiasco. These things come out in congressional hearings. They don't anymore come out as they should do from journalists. Okay, well, I think Jim will be back on Monday as usual, and thank you very much for listening. Go to those sites which we mentioned, or Chance mentioned, for a look. Yes, and have a look at some of the fantastic programs that are there. Thank you very much for your attention, and wishing you well until we meet again. Goodbye.